Go on, bub.
The Top 100 Project is sponsored by Sparkplug Coffee. It's time to upgrade your morning and your life by switching to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium, ethically sourced Arabica beans. They offer a variety of blends, including decaf, half-calf, and a rotating seasonal blend to keep it interesting. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this fantastic coffee to you in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it so that it always reaches you, guaranteed fresh, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or you can join the Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries. It's completely flexible and customizable. It's got all the convenience with none of the commitment. And because you're a Top 100 listener, Sparkplug is giving you 20% off your next order. Just use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word with the number 100. The time has never been better to start drinking the best coffee of your life. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Good job, bub.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Kia ora, fellow travelers, and thanks for letting us press our forehead and nose to your forehead and nose as the Ellis's Analysis prattles on for the 416th time. We've covered plenty of films from other countries over the past 8.5 years, going on 9 years. But our initial hook was to review all 123 American Film Institute greats on their 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. We warn you now, as we always do at this point, that we spoil, and we also warn you that we've got one hell of a loud night around here tonight, and we did not put up our temporary audio fixing solution above us, a pseudo-ceiling. I promise one day I'm going to fix this, hopefully soon. Back to hollowness here this week. You're going to hear the neighbor, you're going to hear sirens, you're going to hear wind, you're going to hear echo, 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 echo. I'm the hard ass who mopes in bed and is always at war with himself about tradition and expectations versus unconditional love, Ryan Ellis. And here's the go-getter who can hear whales and is not only not the one to blame, she's the one to follow, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
How embarrassing. The one you didn't respect at all is going to be the leader of your tribe. Did he have to see the holes in the palms, doubting Thomas? I can't believe you, Jesus. Oh, it's you. All right, that's going to be a big theme in this podcast. The grandfather's
reticence
and the way he treats her. Okay, the coming attractions opinion question for Whale Rider. Will this be the first time Ryan openly sheds tears in front of Bev during a Top 100 Project movie?
I forgot to keep an eye on you. Did you openly shed tears?
Not even close.
Oh.
It did not happen, but we had to take a fairly long break for dog needs right around the time of Pi's teary tribute to Koro. So that destroyed the tempo. I think that's what's always gotten me in the past. When she breaks down and she loves him so much, he's never really truly shown it back. And she said, he's the guest of honor, I'm inviting you, and he's not there. Although he is dressed, he is going. Why he's going so late, I don't know.
Why didn't he just go with everybody else?
Mm-hmm. Would have missed the performance anyway, I think, by the looks of it, regardless of the whale distraction. But in any case, that's what really got me in the past. And also just the finale, when she is on the whale and she becomes the new Pikeo. She's named after this guy. This is one of those movies where if she doesn't ride a whale, I want my money back. This movie really sets up that that's where it's going. Okay, Cold Grandpa was released by New Market Films over here in North America in June 2003. Success! It went on to rake in about 10 times its budget worldwide. But Bev, the movie is, what did I say, 18 plus years old, so you might want to remind people it's about. So give us a skinny on Whale Rider.
Keisha Castle Hughes is Pikea, the only child and heir of a long legacy of Maori chiefs. The only problem? She's a girl! A fact that seems to bother no one except Pi's beloved grandfather, who blames all his community's problems on the fact that Pi survived while her twin brother didn't. Desperate to win her grandfather's approval, Pi emulates the chief he wished she was, going as far as to communicate with the whales and even performing the miracle of riding a beach whale back into the ocean, finally proving her worth.
Yeah, I took that.
Right.
Or in a nutshell, I didn't know it, but she's the one. Same year as Matrix Reloaded and Revolutions, and that's the over-the-top line from Tank. I knew it. He's the one. That's from 99's Matrix, of course, but you get what I'm going for there. A lot of movies have been all about being the one. Harry Potter, we know. Luke Skywalker in Star Wars.
Isn't that a big component of the hero's journey. The whole Joseph Campbell, some unassuming hero who's just living their normal life and then discovers that the whole world actually does revolve around them and they're incredibly special.
I wonder why people who make movies and do art for a living would be obsessed with that theory and that topic.
Well, it's not just them. It's all the people who buy the books and watch the movies. It's a really popular notion to enjoy. It's a popular fantasy to fulfill.
Okay, well, the numbers on Whale Rider, the Rotten Tomatoes critics numbers are very strong. 91% of critics like the film, 156 reviews, so it's a good sample there. And 88% of audiences. Everyone seemed to love this movie in 2002, really, because it got released, I guess, at festivals. But I think it was 2003, because that's when I saw it. It was the summer of that year. It was 110th at the 2003 U.S. box office. Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, the Best Picture winner, was number one. Elf, which we covered quite a few years ago, was number seven. And Kill Bill Volume 1, which we've also covered in the past, was number 40. And none of those movies have anything in common, really. Well, I guess maybe Lord of the Rings with
Frodo. Lord of the Rings has a huge... This movie probably wouldn't exist without Lord of the Rings. Because after Peter Jackson took all that money to New Zealand and basically created a film industry by effectively teaching people how to make movies on a Hollywood scale to a Hollywood standard... The standard of movies that were coming out of New Zealand after Lord of the Rings versus before Lord of the Rings is astronomically better. And I think it's just because once you teach crews, then the people who have the vision have people who know what they're doing to make their movies for them. He did a lot for New Zealand, and some incredible artists have come out as a result. I feel like New Zealand is this great example of how talent is fostered everywhere. And if you give them the resources and the training to make their craft, then you'll discover the world is full of geniuses.
Even it's girls! Like,
even girls! Because this was a lady director. lady director, but...
Well, like I said last week leading into this, we've covered a lot of movies that have been women-centric this entire year, but not that many women directors. Because I don't want to just cover movies, and yeah, I'm sure you don't either, directed by women just for that sake. Because there's pandering involved with that. You want to cover movies that are zeitgeisty that matter. Maybe this isn't.
I think we could find a lot of really great films directed by women, but the problem is not very many people have seen them. That doesn't make them lesser films. It means that there's just way less interest in talking about those films, listening to podcasts about those films.
Well, we do cover art films like this, if this is an art film, and I guess it is, on a fairly regular basis, but we do try to mix in the bigger hits. And of course, we usually go for some kind of anniversary or a movie's coming out. We would have done Top Gun, I think, right around this space if it hadn't got pushed back yet again because it was going to be coming out. It also is the 35th anniversary this year anyway, but then it got pushed into, I think, next summer. But as far as Lord of the Rings, as soon as you started talking, people can't see me, of course. I was doing a mea culpa, hitting my head. Of course, yes, there are great connections. I was just picturing the violence and the epic scope, and this movie is not like that. But otherwise, what you said definitely does apply. Also, Whale Rider was nominated for one Oscar. Keisha Castle Hughes, the youngest ever Best Actress nomination in history, until a few years later when Kwavanjene Wallace was nominated for Beasts of the Southern Wild, and she's the youngest ever.
She was only 9.
That'll be hard to top.
Oh, yeah.
Keisha Castle Hughes was 12 or 13 years old at that point. And that's something else. I don't know there are too many Best Actor nominees. Are there any, actually, that are even close to that young? I can't even think of one.
You know, it's funny as I'm thinking now, but really young Oscar nominees, and the first thing I always think of is Anna Paquin for another movie, Made in New Zealand.
Which we've covered, directed by a woman.
The Piano, directed by a woman, Made in New Zealand, before Lord of the Rings came over there. Mm. Excellent movie and an excellent performance in that film. But yeah, it's an interesting connection. But supporting actress, yeah.
And this is not a token thing. Let's get the young girl in there. Let's be different for once in 2003. She is the lead of this movie. She's in most of the scenes, and she is by far the driving force of the whole project.
She's wonderful. Her performance 100% earned that Oscar nomination.
And it's her debut.
Kudos to the casting agent who auditioned something like 10,000 girls before she narrowed it down and found Keisha Castle Hughes. She was the one in 10,000.
Scarlett Johansson probably piped up and said, I could do it.
She was too old by then.
She wasn't that much older, actually, than Keisha Castle Hughes in 2003. Yeah, the movie was made from November 2001 to February 2002 in New Zealand, and it doesn't exactly appear warm on a regular basis in this movie. I don't know if New Zealand and the coast and whatnot, because when we see the mountains in the Lord of the Rings movies, obviously it's cold up in mountains no matter where you are. There are lots of places that are near or at the equator that have snow because of the height when they're in the mountains. But they are by the ocean, obviously, with the whale scenes. They seem to live right there. Well, obviously they live right there because when Koro comes out to go to the performance, he's distracted by whales. It's not like he has to walk miles. He has to walk feet. But I guess maybe it's their winter. But then again, wait a minute. That's the southern hemisphere, so that's their summer, isn't it?
Well, their winter is when it's cold, but their winter happens in June, July, August. And their summer happens in December,
but
January,
this movie doesn't
February.
Feel like it's hot or even necessarily all that warm,
well,
is my point.
Even if they have a colder winter, which I think that they have.
But this is their summer
same...
when they shot it.
It is?
I've just said it's November to February.
Well, they're pretty far south. I remember finding this website once where you could find out where you would end up if you dug through where you are on Earth all the way through to the other side of the planet. And it pretty much took me from Toronto to about New Zealand. It's about the same, I guess, distance from the equator southwise as we are northwise.
Well, we get awfully hot in our summers here. This has been a long tangent about weather.
Well, you have the ocean making it temperate too. An island nation is going to have completely different weather. Our weather is completely different because we're so far from either ocean.
Okay, well, we're deep into the podcast. I don't know when you last saw this movie. For me, it's been quite a long time. Like I said, I was interrupted by dog needs. A, he had to poop, and then B, you had to clean him. Wrecked the tempo of the movie.
Dumb dog.
But I still enjoyed myself watching it, as I always have. What'd you think of it this time?
I like this movie a lot. I wouldn't say I love it, but I like it a lot. It transcends that coming of age / overcoming discrimination cliche that it draws from a lot, due in no small part to Keisha Cashel Hughes and that miracle of a performance that she gives.
She was only in 12 movies. This is her first one. She was in a very brief role in Star Wars 3. I think she's supposed to be the new queen of Naboo. And she played Mary in the Nativity story. But that's all I can really find that stands out in any kind of way whatsoever. And how does this young girl...
She was in Game of Thrones.
Oh, right. I look at movies. That's why. I forget about the TV stuff sometimes unless
I
really...
She didn't have a very big part in Game of Thrones.
You said when it was over that she's one of the lesser sisters. It's not like she's even the lead sister of the Sand Snakes in Game of Thrones. And even if she was, it's not like that's a key part of the show. It's not like she played Sansa or Arya.
I remember being really excited when I saw that she had been cast in Game of Thrones because I hadn't really seen her do anything since Whale Rider. I couldn't wait to see her all grown up.
And you barely did.
And you barely see her. It was very disappointing.
Okay, let's get into the whole thrust of this movie. It's obviously deliberate. It's not like it's a subtle thing or you're going to miss it if you watch this movie. It's the entire storyline, but that is the clash between a grandfather who wanted a grandson and the grandson dies in childbirth versus a granddaughter who you know he loves. I think there's a lot going on under the surface of Rawiri Paratine's performance, but I do think this time, at least watching it, that Nicky Caro maybe asked him to be a little too harsh, a little too often. The only real true thing I could think of where he shows his softness, well, okay, one other thing in a second, but it's when he rides around with her on the bike. He never smiles. It's not like there's a little moment where she's not looking and he has this look on his face of bliss of, I may be fighting this and I have to fight this and I'm fighting myself about the fact I'm fighting this, but wow, I love this little girl so much. The one thing I think you could say where he gives away what he really feels about her before the end of the movie is when she leaves to go off with her father, and he hugs her after riding around with her a little bit, but then he goes in the house. He won't actually see her go. I think he probably knows himself enough to know that he would have broken down and cried if he didn't get out of there. I think that's what that was. But other than that, and I know you agree with this, he is a hard ass, like I said, all the way through. And I do think she asked Paratine to be a little bit too hard, too often, for too long.
It could be the 20 years that have passed since this movie was written and made, and that we see masculinity a little bit differently. I'm going to say the thing I've said 100,000 times on this podcast and in life. The patriarchy hurts everybody. He is hurting her, and he is hurting himself.
And the community.
And he is hurting the community. I know you're really supposed to root for his arc. I know I'm supposed to just be pleased when he comes around at the end, but I hate him. He doesn't deserve pie. He deserves to be lonely. He sees this problem in his community, and instead of investing time and energy into fixing that problem, which they're actually pretty vague about, I think it's a mistake that the movie makes that it never really defines what's going wrong that he needs to fix.
It doesn't seem so bad, because no matter how big life's problems are, you still live in New Zealand.
Well, they clearly are illustrating there is a pretty profound level of poverty going on in this community. You see hints that crime is a real issue, and especially with the young men that we meet in the movie that are Pi's peers, the risk of them turning to crime is real. In general, these people don't have a lot. But you're right. They have each other. They live in this really beautiful part of the world. They have this very strong community, and they clearly all love each other and are dedicated to this community. It's kind of hard to understand what the problem is that Koro is trying to solve. Instead of trying to fix the problem, be it poverty or crime,
he sulks.
He finds someone to blame. Worse than
who's to blame?
He sulks too, like a child. And then who does he blame? It's Pi. It's a child's fault for surviving instead of her brother. It's an easy answer, and it's the answer of someone who either doesn't know what they're doing, doesn't want to admit they don't know what they're doing, or worse, knows what needs to be done but would rather point fingers because it's easier. So his strategy is cruelty and these arbitrary rules and standards that aren't going to help anyone. It's the same instinct that makes people react to the pandemic by beating up the first Asian person they see, or made towns burn women alive as witches because their crops failed. And Grandpa isn't disabused of any of his notions either. He simply edits the one arbitrary rule that allows Pi to fit into his worldview, and he only comes around on this because she literally performs a miracle and almost dies trying to win him over. The thing the movie does so right is that Pi, rather than being motivated because she wants to be chief, which I think is the facile way to tell this story, the way that most cliche feminist stories let me down, is that they're like, well, you can't be chief. Sure you can. All you have to do is be better than everybody else. I don't really get the sense from Pi that her goal is to be chief, to fill the role of Paikia, like her namesake, and fulfill this prophecy or whatever of her grandfather's to save her people. I just sense that she loves him so much and she wants him to love her back. That's her motive. So she chooses to pursue something that she thinks will make him happy. She had this closeness with him that she lost. She wants it back. That's such a relatable goal. So she's just trying to make him love her. It's way more relatable than a child who wants to be chief.
Well, one of the key things in the movie, too, is that once she dives in and gets the shark tooth that he threw in the water for the young boys to go find, which they did not, and her fat uncle, and I'll say that because I'm fat, too, Rawiri, so the same first name, he's not that huge, really, but the same first name for the character Grant Roa plays as the actor who plays Koro, Rawiri, R-A-W-I-R-I. My favorite character in the whole film, by the way, Nanny's right behind him, his mother. But anyway,
distant third.
Oh, she's awesome, too. But she's got to play the Luke Skywalker role. I think Luke Skywalker, Mark Hamill, is wonderful in all the Star Wars films, but he's always going to be upstaged by the more fun Han Solo or the stoic Alec Guinness or even Carrie Fisher's part. Harry Potter has the same issue. Frodo Baggins has the same issue. I could keep on going on. They're almost never the best character in their movie, despite the fact they're the most important character in the whole film.
So often they're meant to be a cipher so that any audience member can relate to them and enter the story.
Neo in The Matrix is another one, yes. So anyway, her uncle is such a great character. Grant Roa didn't act all that much. He's actually working in visual effects now, and maybe before this. He only made 6 movies, or only has made as an actor. He's a small role in Lord of the Rings, I guess because I shot in New Zealand. He just probably went along and said, well, you need thousands of people. Can I be one of the thousands? Maybe Nikki Caro saw that her father, meaning Cliff Curtis's character, and her uncle could redeem the father. Because he obviously is hard on Pi when she's first born. He's so disappointed. He doesn't even want to hold his granddaughter. And again, I think there's that flicker, but maybe Caro and Paratine should have played up a little bit more, not much more, just a touch more, when he first holds her the day she's born, as if, no, I don't want this kid. My wife's making me hold her. I'm in love. And he doesn't quite betray that, which I normally would love, but in this movie, it just gets laid on so thick all the way through that would have been nice if there's that little flicker then. I guess you're supposed to just believe and you know where the story's going, maybe, if you've ever seen 5 movies in your life.
And the flicker happens, I think, when they're on the bike together, as you said before.
Right, that's the key thing, is always the bike rides. And I think that's what Caro thinks is enough, and maybe it's not.
And her love for him teaches us that he obviously has been a good grandfather for most of us.
The fact that she ever wants his approval and all that stuff, yes, right. But her uncle, in the whale saving sequence towards the end, and if we hadn't been interrupted, I think that would have maybe really put me over the edge. And maybe it did before. I don't remember how I felt when I first saw the movie, but I know I loved it when I saw it in 2003. And her tribute to her grandfather at that performance, when he's not there and she starts crying, of course reminds us of Train to Busan, which we saw only a few weeks ago. where the girl is not singing well because her dad's not there. No, we're talking about the flashback, not the end of the movie you're thinking of right now.
Did that make you cry? Did you cry at the end of Train to Busan? You didn't, did
no,
you?
No, I didn't. No, no. I'm talking about me as, like, when they show like her child. Performing.
Yeah, no, that, I know what you're talking
What's
about.
That song? You remember what that song is.
Oh, it's Aloha.
Right.
Yeah. Na, na, na,
na. But she's bad, and she says later on, I was bad because you weren't there. So it reminded me of that, even though Paikea's song is not bad. But then I think it's right after that, or very soon after that, where we see Rawiri come in and say to his mother, you better come take a look at this because it's all the beach whales. And then the next 10, 15 minutes of the movie is seemingly the whole community helping out to try to save these beach whales. This is all that matters. So if Koro had to miss her performance, it's never said, but I don't think that Nanny or Pai would ever judge him for missing the performance for that reason, because he was tied up with something that mattered more. And she, of course, as we learn in the story in this mystical movie, it is a bit of a sci-fi movie in some ways, has called the whales in the first place. She called the lead whale that Paikea had ridden, and then all the whales follow, but now they're just beached and don't know how to get back out. But even when they're all trying, certainly led by Rawiri, a very key line in this movie, I love this line so much, is when Koro says to Rawiri about the group, they're exhausted, is what Rawiri has said. They're tired, they've been up all night, they can't do it. They will if you lead them.
Yeah, speaking to
him. And he's never really shown his second son that much respect. He doesn't seem to judge him as harshly as he does his oldest son, Cliff Curtis's character,
even though we or his granddaughter. That when he was younger, he won competitions
with the haka, yeah.
Yeah, the stick fighting thing that they did.
My second haka experience this year with podcast movies, because Chris and I covered Invictus quite a few months ago, and there's a haka dance in that because South Africa plays New Zealand in the World Cup finals. Ah. And we see that whole
the tongue thing. I've seen YouTube videos of real Maori people doing this dance. It's cool, man.
It's impressive, yeah. Maybe that's one reason why in previous viewings I was a puddle, because that whole buildup, her performance at the show, then you see why Carl missed it, then you see what they're all doing, the whole community is doing to try to help these whales. This nice thing that this hard man has said to his younger son, they'll follow you. And they all try, but then it doesn't work. And it's almost like, as she says in voiceover, the whale doesn't want to live.
And he has that moment of kindness with his son, but she comes and she tries to push to touch the whale. And he won't even let her touch the whale. You've done enough. As in, this is your fault. You, a tween girl who has nothing to do with this. And he is happy to place all the blame on her shoulders. His redemption is tough, man. It is a tough sell.
The funny thing, too, is that he wouldn't at that point believe that she called the whales in, which would be a strange thing anyway for them to do if they want to help. What are they going to do? They can't climb on land and solve these problems. But if he wants to believe that she's done that, then he should start to believe that she's the one.
But he believes in her attempts to do good and her attempts to be like the men, that she has angered the gods or confused the whales. Her stepping out of line is what caused all the problems.
Because she's a girl.
Because she's a girl!
I will state what I've said before on podcasts with Chris when we've talked about women-led movies. We've covered several, not that many maybe, sports movies with women in the lead roles. Or it's just come up maybe sometimes when they weren't even the subject of the movie. There will come a time when either a woman or someone who doesn't identify as either sex, many years down the road maybe, is considered the greatest athlete of all time. Is that true now? No, probably not. The greatest athletes, Muhammad Ali, Michael Jordan, those kinds of people are probably top of the list. Not to say there aren't some women on that list, but are they one and two? No, probably not. But I think there will come a time when a woman could very easily be number one. If you believe that's possible, then you can't be a Koro. You can never be put in the same box as Koro, because my whole thing is, so there's a prophecy. Twins were born. One of them died. I wish it was the grandson who lived. It's the granddaughter, who I love anyway. Maybe she's the one who's special, is what you maybe should be believing all along, especially once things like the whales thing happens. And then he sees her riding, and it's almost like he still doesn't believe that she's the special one until Nanny hands him the tooth. Who found it? Who do you think? Until he's finally admitting.
Her performance at that moment. Who do you think? She gives him the gears, at least. I understand that the reason for his behavior, for his cruelty, is because he really is a true believer, and he believes that if he follows the rules to the letter, and if everybody else just followed the rules to the letter, that everything would be okay.
Who wrote these rules down?
Every culture has rules, right? You could liken it to people who are just hypervigilant Christians or hypervigilant woke people who think somehow if we all are perfect all the time, all the problems of the world will be solved and we'll all have it all figured out. And he's that kind of person. I don't like people like that under most circumstances. So I kind of want to come back to what you were saying about women in films and, let's just say, films that focus on strong female characters. Hollywood has this reductive trope about the, quote, strong female character. They're exceptional and they're badass. And most of all, they're not like other girls. They excel at masculine pursuits, whether it's being a warrior like Pi or Princess Leia
Mulan.
Or Wonder Woman. Mulan, another great example. Also, the live-action Mulan was directed by Nikki Caro, where you can totally see the through line where an executive was like, well, she's already kind of low-key made this movie.
This movie got her Mulan, without a doubt.
Oh, yeah, sure. And then there's similar stereotypes where you have the Jo March or the Hermione Granger, who's the smartest girl in the room. In the worst examples of this, they just overcome sexism by simply being stronger, smarter, more exceptional than every other person in the story. They aren't really subverting sexism. They're personally overcoming it. And the best stories like this can absolutely be fun to watch. Wonder Woman, great example. Captain Marvel, another one. But they always fall short from being inspiring, at least to me. Or even all that progressive, in my opinion. Because they're not really about taking down sexism. The only way to take it down is to literally be better than everyone else. And that's not equity, not even close. Will Ryder is a little guilty of this trope because Pi does overcome sexism by being better than the boys. But I think it also transgresses it because she doesn't want to be chief. It's not like, I can't remember her name, but the lead character in Brave who just wants to be like the boys. No, Pi just wants to be Pi. She wants to be herself, and she herself is a girl. She could want all kinds of things. She just wants her grandfather's love. She doesn't want to be the one that her grandfather is seeking to lift their people from poverty.
I didn't know
she
it.
Just wants her grandfather to love her.
She's the one.
Yes, yes, we heard you. Let me get my point out. She just wants to matter in his eyes and have value in their community. And the only way she sees to do that is to be that hero who can fight and dive. And when she speaks, the gods listen to her, the whales listen to her. And I think that this movie, when it gets to me, it gets to the idea that this is a girl, like a lot of little girls out there, who is loved less than her brothers. Even her dead brother, she can't measure up to. I think there's probably a lot of girls and women who grew up with brothers who fundamentally understood that they were less valuable. I grew up with two sisters, but I'm super grateful I didn't have a brother because I don't want to know how much my parents would have treated a brother differently than they treated me and my sisters.
I think a key thing in this movie for her is that she seems to want to do these things. She's not doing them to impress anyone, and she's not doing it, as you said, to try to take over this community and be the chief. She likes doing stuff. She's snooping when Koro's training the young boys with the haka dance and with the, whatever they call that, stick thing that she beats Hemi with. And I like not just her uncle and even her dad, who's not in the movie that much, but Hemi is supportive of her. He doesn't say it literally. But if someone were to say to him, if Cora were to ask him, what do you think of this? Well, she's better than me. Train her. Make her the chief of your community.
Hemi's another great character and somebody that they could have so easily done like a cheap and dirty writing job with him and turned him into the bully, the naysayer who wants to be better than her and then gets his comeuppance at some point in the film. But no, he respects her. He really likes her. And he helps her to his own harm. He gets in
Koro kicks him out of their group, yeah. Basically.
Another crazy bad thing that Koro does. If you're trying to overcome poverty and crime in your community, here's a kid who's so vulnerable, who seems to be doing well and thriving, and you're going to kick him out because he helped your granddaughter? Mm-hmm. The amount of harm that he does with his misguided attempts to control everything.
Maybe that's what Carol's trying to do then. She does lay it on too much with the grandfather, but he is the patriarchy incarnate, and that's what they do so often. And they don't necessarily ever soften. Don't we all wish that so many people in the Senate in America right now, or Congress, would have that moment like Senator Payne does and Mr. Smith goes to Washington? I'm guilty. Throw me out of this chamber. I don't belong here. It's that boy who's innocent. I'm guilty. I like that movie. And that's a pretty well-played scene by Claude Rains, but so remarkably unbelievable even then and certainly now, where standards and morals don't mean anything in government from most of the people in government. So maybe that's what she's doing is saying, these are the kinds of people, and Koro represents them, that are in charge of things. And it's going to take so much. It's going to take somebody walking up and, like the guy says in Jaws, biting you in the ass, or swimming up and biting you in the ass, to prove to you just how serious this is in the case of Jaws, or just how much you're wrong in the case of Whale Rider. Let her train. Let her be the one. Okay, you won't do that. She'll prove to you she's the one. And then finally, now you believe. And I guess he finally does at the end. It is very sweet, though, that last shot. And everything comes together because there are women on that boat that Purarangi, Cliff Curtis's character, finishes. It's been about 12, 13 years since he started building that boat without finishing it. It was supposed to be for his son, and he gave up. And he's also an artist, but then an artist can make a pretty good boat, I guess, especially when it comes to drawing on it, painting on it. But he's part of the first launch, and his brother, they're the first two. But the women are in there, too, and then we don't see it till the end because the movie does set up that maybe Pi is, I guess, not going to die because she's still alive in the hospital. Somehow survived a pseudo-drowning, but she's special. She's got a bit of a whale tendency now, I guess. She's like Tom Hanks in Splash, maybe. And so at the end, you've got this mixture of men and women that are in the boat. You've got men and women, mostly women, but men and women who are singing along and doing a haka dance of their own while they do launch the boat. And right in the middle, yes, the chief, meaning Koro, the grandfather who represents the entire community, but right beside him and very proud beside him, well, sorry, he's proud about her, is Pi.
Yeah, when he comes around hard. When she's in the coma or she wakes up, he apologizes to her. That's a moment of such humility, and that's how you know that, as frustrating as it is because he's almost a villain, when he comes around, there's true and pure contrition on his part.
I'm wondering if after this, when they just live their lives in their small little house by the water, Pi says or does something. Nanny says, no, that's not good. And he stands up, no, whatever she says must be true. It must be right. So you listen to her, Nanny. So it's the opposite. Or she can't right. be wrong about anything.
Oh my God. I wish they kind of written that into the script somehow.
She's the chosen one.
Yeah. Hello.
Listen, dear, who she threatens to divorce many times over. A fun running gag in that, which is also in October Sky in 1999. It's a good running gag.
And as I was screaming by the end of the movie, just leave him. There's a moment in the film, and this is such an irredeemable thing to me, and it happens in so many movies, where there's a man, and he's the patriarch of his family, and he gets so mad that he breaks something, that he throws a dish, or whatever. The woman grumpily cleans it up, and she even says in this movie,
it's my kitchen,
because he wants Pi to clean up his mess, you monster. But instead, she starts cleaning it up, and he gets mad at her, and she's like, this is my kitchen, and I'll clean up the mess I want. He should be cleaning it up. The audacity and the pure patriarchy at work, where a man gets to have a temper tantrum like a child, and the women are fighting over who gets to clean up after him.
Well, this isn't going to help your rage right now. I was reading that the cast and crew did tribal chants to avoid bad luck, because in their story, just their fictional story, the girl was allowed to do boy things.
Are you serious?
And Nikki Caro, again, is the writer and director of this movie, adapting, what is his name, Witty Ihimara? Hope I said that right. I think it's a he, 1987 book that this guy wrote, this person wrote. So Nikki Caro either authorized it or let it happen. It's almost like you had to bless the set in The Exorcist because of all the weird things that were happening. And oh my God, what's the devil going to do?
They can do whatever they want. She can't necessarily stop them one way or the other.
My point being that even in their fictional film, they had to go by this whole notion of, but the girl is doing boy things, let's not anger the gods.
Oh my God.
And they romanticize their ancestors in this movie so much, it is a little bit much when they've been forsaken. Why have you forsaken me? Well, Paikeas, they're not god, but they're whatever you want to call them exactly, and he's forsaken them.
Yeah, their strong ancestor. I did enjoy the way that they display culture in this film. Pi and her grandfather both enjoy a really strong connection to their heritage and their culture, and I'm glad there's a strong counterpoint to the grandfather's rigidity. Pi really gains strength and a sense of belonging from the rituals she's been taught. So it doesn't have to be one way or the other. These can have value even though they can be overdone by certain members of the community. She can follow her dad to Germany, but she just can't bear to be parted from this place where she's from and where she belongs. And the film draws a really elegant line between the culture and Pi's sense of self. So I think it really beautifully illustrates the value of traditions and community, even though they can obviously be very harmful sometimes.
Her dad is a deadbeat dad, too, because he's not been in her life for a long time, but she doesn't hold it against him. He must see her fairly often, because it's not like they meet up in that scene where he's showing his slides, his boring-ass vacation slides, and his art that they're all tolerating, and then in comes a lady, very lovely lady, the teacher, who's leading the kids through that whole thing at the end, the tribute that Pi pays to her grandfather. But Koro brought her over for the sake of meeting Purarangi. But then he says, oh, I got somebody else pregnant. Okay, she can go home.
Immediately. embarrassing for everybody involved.
But Pi's father has not been around through a whole life, obviously, so he must come around fairly often. But he's been a bit of a deadbeat dad. And she's been raised by her grandparents. But then when you talk about it, I think Hillary Clinton wrote this book, It Takes a Village to Raise a Child, is the rest of that phrase. Well, that's what's exactly going on in this movie, including her uncle and her uncle's girlfriend. And, of course, her grandparents themselves and her grandmother's friends. The whole smoking scene, that's fun, too. And they got to put up the cigarettes. No one will ever know we were smoking a minute ago. But so many people in this community have cared about Pi and the other kids all along. You said at one point there are no girls in this. We do see them, especially that performance.
At the end. But she has no girlfriends that she hangs out with. The only women you see are Nanny, her brother's girlfriend. But it feels like everybody else in this film that has a line, let's say, is a guy.
I think they're stacking the deck. That's why.
It must be a choice. But it frustrates me because I feel like this happens in movies all the time. Even when they're casting extras, the typical things, it's like 75% men and 25% women, which is so bizarre and frustrating because it's deeply inaccurate, but it's also, I think, harmful because I think it plays into the notion that people are men and women are this deviation from men, whereas it's the opposite. There is actually more of us than there are of you.
But there's a reason for it in this case.
I guess so, and she's trying to be like the boys, so she's hanging out with the boys. It's just something that I noticed. There were scenes where she's singing with her class, and her class is 90% boys. And at the very end, you see other girls. But it's a bizarre choice to make when you're trying to make the point that women also have value. Not only do we have value, but we exist. We make up more than 50% of most classes.
Well, Kara was new to making movies at this point. I don't know if this is her first. I don't think it was. But it was one of her first. By the way, one of our next movies, North Country, NC, her name, NC. Doesn't mean much, but I'm just looking at my notes here. Notice that. But maybe the idea is we'll slowly but surely bring more than just those key women into this movie. Because the women, apart from the uncle, have the best roles in the movie. The lead character and her grandmother and the uncle are my three favorite characters. I think Coro's well played, and he's maybe got the most screen time. It's pretty much a two-hander, I guess, with Keisha Castle Hughes. But maybe that's the idea that Kara was going for, and maybe it was also in the book, I don't know, where you don't really see that many women that do matter through so much of the story, but then in the last key scenes, the whole saving the whale scene, there are plenty of women in that. Mm. Not really girls, but a lot of women. The performance the night before, where she bears her soul, you see more girls there. And then, like I say, there are girls in the boat. This isn't just launching a boat with dudes. And then the haka dance isn't just dudes. It's fairly even at that point, and maybe that's Carol's intention. You're not really going to see too many women other than the really, truly main characters until it matters in the last, say, half hour, when so many big things happen.
It's probably intentional. I think it just triggers me because so often films do it unintentionally because of their subconscious bias.
And then Pi climbs on the whale's back and spikes her heels in like it's a horse. And they manage to swim. She probably should have drowned, but I guess maybe she's special and she's the one. So I said she's making her debut here, as was Rachel House, who does play the girlfriend of the uncle I like so much, Shiloh. Maybe it's pronounced Shiloh. I don't remember hearing her name, so it's looking like Shiloh in any case. That was Fox's name, right, before you got him?
Yeah, our dog Fox, before I adopted him, his name was Shiloh.
He's just not a Shiloh.
No, he was such a fox. He looked like a fox, so.
Well, you've seen and heard her plenty of times since, because she was in Hunt for the Wilder People. And she was also a voice in Moana and Soul. So she's done plenty of big things. I mentioned Grant Roa has not worked that much as an actor, but he is in visual effects now. Cliff Curtis, who does play, I'm probably saying it wrong, but Pururangi. Oh my God, the wind. He was in The Piano and Three Kings, two movies we previously covered, and he will be in the Avatar sequels, movies we won't cover, but he's had quite a career. And I think he's pretty good casting. He's probably the best known actor. He is the best known actor of all these people, at least in this part of the world.
He got the end credit, even though he has a relatively small part.
Mm-hmm. But it's Vicky Houghton, who does play Nanny Flowers. Only made 8 movies. She's in the 2005 King Kong, so the Peter Jackson one. I don't recall, but I'm going to guess she's one of the people on the island. And Peter Jackson does play into that cliche of the savages when they do get to the island in King Kong.
She's so lovely, as you say, in this film. Actually, it reminds me of Hunt for the Wilder People. I can't remember the character's name, but the woman who takes in the foster, Ricky. Ricky Baker.
I'm going to look it up because I wonder if maybe she is the one who does play the mother, the whatever pseudo-mother. Now, Bella Faulkner's character?
Yeah, Bella Faulkner.
So Rachel House is a different character.
She's okay. The child safety agent, the truant officer, whatever her situation
many
is.
Years
she's very
this
funny.
Movie.
She's in a lot of Taika Waititi stuff.
Well, talking about her right now reminds me that a key moment in this, Roger Ebert, I remember being apoplectic about this, that this film was not G-rated. There's no sex, there's no violence, there's no bad language, but there's a microsecond, okay, literally probably a second and a half, but a very brief period of time when Rawiri is lounging with his girlfriend, and as Pi comes up, because she wants to learn the haka dance, he's got pot paraphernalia on his chest, and when she taps him on the shoulder, oh, no, no, you don't see that. It doesn't mean anything. They weren't actually literally doing it on screen, but oh no, PG.
Yeah, a little kid that isn't old enough to know.
I didn't recognize it when I saw this movie.
No, exactly. Kids, it just goes right over their heads and they just move on with the story. They don't pay attention to that kind of thing. It's so funny when I watch films that I saw as a kid that I've shown and have watched, but the fact is I just didn't catch on. You know, kids don't understand most of what's coming at them anyway, so when something like that goes over their head, they just move on because it's not important enough to matter. It should have been a G-rated film. And he thinks that every girl, especially in the world, and boys too for that matter, should be watching a movie like this. It is meant for kids to watch. It's so inspiring and lovely and honest.
And not need parents with them to do it.
Exactly. They should have access to a movie like this. I mean, as much access as any kid's going to have to a foreign film. Indie kind of art house film.
Well, they speak English, though, so that definitely helps, though, too. It's not like you have to worry about the whole subtitles thing, which people even now don't want necessarily to do. Okay, so Nicky Caro, who did write and direct, also worked on, as I said, North Country, which was only 2 years later. I think 2 years later.
And starred Charlize Theron, who is the actress who beat Keisha Castle Hughes for that Best Actress
in 2003,
Oscar.
Right. Yeah. And then she was nominated again for that movie. Theron was. I think Frances McDormand was also nominated that year. I haven't seen that movie in a long time. I remember not being a fun experience, but a pretty solid film. Maybe even a very good film. And as I've said before, I think I might have preferred the live-action Mulan to the animated one because I don't think it needs the Eddie Murphy comedy, even though a lot of people miss that dragon character he plays. I thought Mulan was fine. I didn't love it, but I thought it was okay. Meaning the live-action one, which she did direct. And her producers were John Barnett, Frank Hubner, who worked on a movie called Spartan, which probably no one has seen. It was the year after this came out. I like it an awful lot. A David Mamet film. Val Kilmer is the lead of that film. Kristen Bell, before she was all that well-known. Very solid movie. Check it out. We've got it on DVD downstairs. And Tim Sanders also worked on this as a producer. He also worked on Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring. But I don't see any other production credits for the other movies for him. I didn't write down all of them, just Lotter Fodder. Not Lotter Rotka. The movie's 2:35:1. We watched it on Prime, which is not the greatest print of all time. I think mostly the opening scene. I didn't really notice it being bad the whole way through, but you pointed out when it first started during the opening credits, maybe we should have got the DVD from the basement.
We'll watch it on Prime. It'll surely be HD, but it looks like they transferred it from maybe a 3/4 VHS. It does not look good.
Yeah. Cinematographer Leon Narby also shot The Price of Milk and The Tattooist. That movie's the people probably know that well. The editor, David Coulson, a regular with Caro, also cut McFarland, another movie she made, by the way. Chris and I might cover that at some point for Scoring the Movies. It's a track and field movie with Kevin Costner. And he cut Mulan. And the composer, Lisa Gerrard, who we've talked about in the last little while because you and I did Gladiator last year. She's one of the composers on that. And she worked on Ali, which Chris and I just covered. So the look, the cutting, the music, we just said the look isn't the greatest. But if you can see past the not-so-great print, what do you think of the look and the cutting and, of course, the music?
I would say that the technicals were what I would expect from a very good indie art house film from this time and place.
As I recall, the piano DVD, presumably the actual print, was pretty grainy. I think that might have been intentional, though.
Yeah, the print that we saw also didn't look amazing.
And that's Cliff Curtis, that's a New Zealand thing.
But just like the piano, it's all in service of telling the story and getting to the emotional through line, and in that way it succeeds 1,000%.
Would have succeeded more if we didn't have to worry about dog poop.
The filmmakers can't be held responsible for our dog pooping all over his own butt and then stepping in his poop.
Thanks, Sam. Yeah. I wanted to cry for my wife and you ruined it. So what happens next? Well, maybe things don't really get better for this community after all, so they all gang up and throw Pi into the sea. And then she turns into a whale.
She'd be better off with the whales than her grandpa.
Well, if things don't work out, he's going to blame her all over again. He literally says it. Who is to blame for whales being beached? Okay, yeah, we know in this movie, in this storyline that is a little bit mystical and sci-fi, whatever you want to call it, that it is something bigger than that. But why are you blaming people for whales being beached? Pi did call them, but he didn't know that, so why are you blaming anybody? It happened.
And I'm not arguing that that isn't a pretty strong facet of human nature, that we want to both feel like we have control over those things and then feel like we can place blame on somebody else for bad things happening. But what's frustrating is that his arc in particular doesn't really resolve that at all. As a matter of fact, it almost cements his belief that they have control over those things, that he just had one detail wrong. But once you sort that out, then he can carry on believing this is the way things are.
He's a maddening man. Okay, well, then last thoughts on Whale Rider.
It's really lovely for lots of reasons, but especially that heartbreaking, deeply honest performance from such a young actress. I hope that she finds that next great part that she deserves and we get to see more of her.
I don't know why we didn't long ago. It's hard to believe. It's a movie about family and deep love. Well, that and whales. And it's harder to accept just how tough Koro is on Pi than I remember it being before. But you're right. Maybe that's part of the fact that we try to look at things differently than we used to and are harder on this kind of thing. And you can understand it being a story arc. That's fine. But it really is a redemption. If there's any redemption at all for him, it's in the last 5 minutes. Usually when an arc happens, it's a little bit earlier than that. But this is the very last little bit where my granddaughter is in the middle of this boat and she's in charge of all of you. But that's the last shot of the movie, or one of the last shots of the whole movie.
And she has to do way too much to earn his love.
Mm-hmm. But it does remain lovely. I think I maybe would have cried if we hadn't had so many breaks when we were trying to watch the movie. Damn you, Sam!
That's the true advantage of going to see a movie in the theater, is that if your dog poops all over themselves, you are not aware of it.
Yes.
You're somewhere else entirely.
If you miss it, it's because you were not paying attention, you were asleep, or you were in the washroom, and that's your fault. Because the movie's not going to stop for you. Okay, good experience watching Whale Rider. Nikki Caro, good job.
For more from us, you can visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe wherever you listen. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes hundreds of movies that we've covered, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made. While you're there, in exchange for all of our free content, could you leave us a rating and a review? We are both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount.
Thanks for listening, bub.
And cut.